after that splendid doing nothing for more than 1 month. And I would like to make two little announcements. One of them, the first of no importance at all, that is, I would like to discuss with your essays in 2 weeks' time, that is Wednesday after next Wednesday, 3 to 5. Please do come. Second, more important, those who are interested in Buddhism and who have nothing to do at 5 o'clock today, I'm absolutely sure that you have nothing to do at 5 o'clock today. I would invite you to the lecture theater, to the first lecture in the series of lectures given by Professor Kenneth Roy Norman from Cambridge, who is one of the best knowers of Buddhism in the world. I would highly recommend you to go there, even if you are occupied by some businesses, which of course in comparison with this one would be seen as totally insignificant and superfluous. Now, today is our 11th lecture, 11th lesson, and probably it is the last lesson devoted to, I would put it as, more general problems. But take it this lesson is devoted to what I would call a crystallization of ideas in the second half of the first millennium BC. You know, I would like to start with what you know, what all of us, we know it. An idea as such, however extraordinary or interesting, it remains an idea. In order to become a part of culture, an element of that culture's idea, it should be necessary to be crystallized. Crystallized in the sense that to be worked out in such a way to be understandable and usable for practically everybody. In what sense everybody? Everybody who knows its own native language. What comes to my mind is, of course, the ideas which, well, were in fact crystallized in the 17th century and which now we are using without thinking of them. But we can use them only because they have already been crystallized, not invented. You understand the difference? Let us take such dominant idea of European enlightenment as reason. Now you use the term reason without thinking of it. But it is only due to the fact that in the 17th and the beginning of the 18th century it was namely crystallized. That is, it was to such an extent interpreted and reinterpreted in its various senses and meanings that practically it became totally understandable to all those who speak, for instance, in this particular case, English language. And when I am saying, well, when I'm taking as an example such a term as reason, try to indeed become aware of all possible, not only derivations, but shades of that word. We are using it all the time. Yes. When you buy Mercedes-Benz, is it correct? Yes. Because I know nothing about cars. Yes. I heard it somewhere for something like £16,000. Is it correct? While having an overdraft of £100,000, it may be regarded as unreasonable, yes, by your wife, or if your wife does it, well, a stupid cow, yes, then you say it is unreasonable, and if you do it, you are, well, a stupid idiot, etc., etc. The same is when you you are buying a third hand car for £500 or with overdraft £2,500, yes? So that term reasonable is in common use, and while using it we not necessarily remember, but the whole sum total of its implications is within it and is within your linguistic mind. You understand this? And after that, you go to the university, yes, no more cars for any price, yes, you go to the university and where is it? Supposedly university college, there is no philosophy at all, say King's College, or to Oxford, there are still one probably philosopher in the whole Oxford who may teach it, and you start learning the Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant. And then if you are strong enough, without getting to a madhouse, after that you study Critique of Practical Reason of the same great German philosopher. And then you see that there is one human reason, the same reason which buys, or unreason, buys Mercedes-Benz with his or her overdraft or third-rate car, and that very reason in its purified and abstract form was worked out as the most important philosophical category by Immanuel Kant himself, the greatest successor to the ideas of enlightenment coined, polished, crystallized in the 17th century, yes. Of course, the idea of reason is not the only crystallized idea of the early European Enlightenment, and we still feed on it, you know? irrespective who we are, whether we are black on the white or gray or brown or left wing or right wing or any other kind of ideas, yes, we reason. We reason in practically the same way. You understand that? It's an extremely interesting point. Why? Because that notion was not only coined in Europe, but assumed its understandable, usable, and applicable form. Yes? Now you understand what I mean, yes? Speaking of ideas ideas as elements of culture, two totally different things. Of course, we know there were some absolutely remarkable ideas, which were invented probably as early as in the 13th or 14th century, but they did not become part or element of our idiom or our culture for various reasons. Well, let us take such amazingly interesting ideas as those invented or worked out by such outstanding medieval philosophers as, for instance, your compatriot, who was it? Roger Bacon. Please don't confuse him with Francis Bacon. not painter, I mean, but also philosopher, who was far more interesting philosopher than the latter. Anyway, now I would like to return to our Indian stuff. Speaking of such ideas, which for a very long time waited for their crystallization until they in fact became part of culture, I would like to start with the idea of Atmanbrahma. I have already told you something, yes, about that. Am I right? Good. Yes.
Very little.
Yes, in a sort of cursory or passing way. That idea, I, as I understand it, played the role in a way analogous to the idea of enlightenment, to the idea of a reason in our own culture of European enlightenment. Let me again reiterate the point. Now, at the end of the 20th century, we are still living by that idea and other ideas of enlightenment. Of course, they have become old, flabby, shabby, still usable. I personally do not like them, but it's my personal opinion and prejudice. Anyway, what about Brahman and Atman? I like that idea very much, yes. It cannot become old. The late Basham, whose book you have already read, I hope with pleasure, one more. He enumerates the four main meanings of the term Brahman. First of all, Brahman as the universal spirit, as soul of the world. Don't write it down, put it in the book. Don't spend your divine spiritual energy on writing. And yes,
you bring around.
Yeah, of course. The first meaning is the most general and more importantly, the most abstract meaning. In this respect, Brahman is everything, and of course, at the same time, nothing, because you cannot conceive it, you cannot really comprehend it in your human mental, so to speak, psychical way. The second meaning of the term Brahman, as shown in Bhashyam's book, is Brahman, the priest. Mm. Yes. It needs not to be explained. You know who Brahmans were, still are, and to my prediction will be for the next 3 or 4 millennia. The third meaning of the term Brahman or Brahmana is what? A variety of Brahmanical, or for that matter, by derivation, Vedic texts, a special kind of text, usually written and widely so, with a normal being, not counter, with a variety. I would like to add the fourth meaning, which in my opinion was not really omitted by Bhashyam, but he simply didn't think it was necessary to mention it or practically to start it. That is, its primary meaning of Brahman is very mysterious and purely ritualistic and sacrificial. The primary meaning, while deriving probably from the remotest depth of Indo-European, not only Indo-Iranian antiquity, was, do you know what? My young lady.
Is it to do with the sacred?
Sacred what?
Sound of, that was used in ritual.
Derivative, very derivative. Primary meaning, pristine meaning, is connected with two very interesting etymological conjunctures. Now that, I am sure Jean Lar never forgotten to say that. Yes, you are his pupil, yes? Aren't you? As a complaint. It's extremely interesting because in its primary meaning it is connected with the sacred sacrificial grass called Barhis or Barhis. And it is definitely denoted, some say, roughly speaking, 4,000 years ago, yes, just the day before yesterday, it denoted the main, I'm not sure that it is really good English equivalent, the main beam in the house. Is it correct?
Mm.
The central beam. Or, that is, I mean, the sacred beam which was, as I understand it, horizontal, or its opposite, the sacrificial pole, vertical, near the hearth, or before. Sacrificial meaning of the term, of the word Brahman, to me seems to be beyond any drums. It is from that meaning that Brahman in the sense of a priest and in the sense of universal soul, God, Godhead, etc., and other meanings like that were derived in the Vedic or probably pre-Vedic period. But here etymology stops. What is extremely important is that Brahman, which in its main and most abstract meaning of Godhead, universal God, not to speak of a concrete God, Brahman, God creator, yes, as a derivative, yes, as a concretization, but that meaning in the course of time, somewhere to the beginning of the second half of the first millennium BC, was crystallized to such an extent that it started being used in practically even common language as what? Everything divine. But again, it was impossible without the previous crystallization. You cannot concretize anything without previous crystallization of that abstract. And, well, jointly or conjointly with Brahman, we have that indeed most universal term. Let me repeat it. I am sure that I have already mentioned it to you. So, the idea of Atman started, amazingly enough, in a purely linguistic context, in everyday, common, ordinary language. Atman means exactly what in English means a so-called reflexive particle self. But in English there is no, sorry, how many of you have ever studied Sanskrit? You. Splendid. You remember what Atmanapada is? Do explain to the class, quick. It's, as a form of verb, yes, go on.
It's the, when you use the verb to mean either in a passive sense or to refer to back to yourself.
So first of all, refer back to yourself. Yes. Give an example in English. It's very simple, my young lady. Well, it's very simple. In English you may say, for instance, I tell, yes. Or in passive, I am told, yes. So, in Sanskrit there is a third form. I tell for myself. Or shall we say, in a way, I tell myself. That form is called Atmanapada. It's a very, very impressive thing, which indeed means self, by myself, for myself. That is, the action is directed to the language actor, the language agent
to me.
Yes. And the same with other persons, second, third, singular, plural, etc. Well, it's very easy to understand, isn't it?
Yes.
So, when I say in English, for instance, well, what do you think about that? You say, well, I, myself, I know it is class, still you can say, I myself, I have gradually come to conclusion, etc., 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 something stupid usually follows. Yes. You understand this? Well, and even in a clearer way, you read in a novel, something like, after that, she hated herself. Yes, I like such passages, I adore them.
Yes.
It is a typical use of the term self, which assumes the role of a kind of reflexive prefix in English, and it is exactly the role which can be regarded as the primary or one of the earliest primary functions of the term Atman in Sanskrit and in ancient Indian language in general. And after that, well, we observe a long way, shall we say, at least, at the very least, the 100 years long way from self used in that grammatical or shall we say paragrammatical sense to the self as something which is your essence. But to say that self is your essence is too general and therefore wrong. Because when we use the term essence in this Anglo-Saxon dialect called English, the term means my essence, that is, something which is I, but something which is the center of that I, and which is one with I, but in Sanskrit it was not that. It was that kind of essence, shall we say, in terms of metaphor, which is in a way within your eye, but which is not your eye, which is something entirely different. In what way different? In a very simple way, we say, I want, I do not want, I strive, I love, I hate, I eat, and Atman in Indian sense. It does not eat, it does not long, it does not hate, it does not love, it does not even. It is that essence which was understood as above all possible empirical and empirically conceivable modalities. It was something entirely different, something whose may it not only function was what? David?
Well, the function of the Atman?
Yeah.
It's eternity.
Sorry, eternity cannot be function. The only function of Atman was, or sorry, is, because it will be, To know, to witness. To know, not mentally, but not psychically, not by mind, which pertains to your empirical life, but to know really. To know yourself and to know the whole world as it is. Of course, it is much easier to be said than to be understood.
Yes.
I remember it was several years ago, say 15, when I was trying to explain what Atman is to my students here, yes, and then, I explained it to them probably 10 or 12 or 15 times, and usually when I explain somebody something 10 or 15 times, I even start understanding it myself. That couldn't help it, yes, but in that case, I suddenly thought, God Almighty, but the great pupils of the great masters of the Upanishads, they were trying to understand it for a very long time. Let me tell you that to learn about Atman, according to one absolutely miraculous Upanishadic episode, you would have first of all to sacrifice, or to bring, to give to the Brahmins 12,000 cows, yes, and after that study for a period from 17 to 70 years. So how could I, yes, explain it, even if 10 times within 40 or 50 minutes? Ridiculous, yes, but still I can talk about that, which is a totally different thing from explanation or your own understanding. So you see how deadly difficult it is, and how deadly difficult it was for ancient Indians to change it from its most abstract meaning to most concrete meaning. And what was the most concrete meaning of Atman, which in distinction from Brahman, the only distinction is that Atman has more what individual power. So simplifying everything, and of course it is wrong, but it is repeated by all ethologists, good and bad alike, Atman is an individual soul or self, while Brahman is a soul or self of the universe. Well, utterly stupid, but unfortunately unavoidable definition. Yes. So, it reached its stage, this word, Atman, or Brahman, and Atman, probably somewhere in the 4th or 3rd century BC, it reached the stage where it started being used by everybody, not only by learned Brahmins, by everybody, shall we say, literate. That is, it became an element of culture and part of a spoken idiom. It was some 8 years ago, I was quite inexperienced, expertly traveling through Punjab, and after approximately 8 hours to travel in a sort of deadly crowded train, somewhere 4 o'clock in the morning, I found myself up to the platform of a little railway station, and only two vestiges of modern civilization were in view. It was a tank with soldiers and officers around it, because at that time they were fighting Khalistani Sikh separatists in Punjab, and it was a gigantic television screen on the platform showing some idiotic film, Indian, you know, Indian cinematography is tremendously bad, absolutely hellishly disastrous. Yes, you are not offended, I hope. Yes.
I agree.
Yes. Well, it is enough to say that it is even worse than third-rate American which is a lot, yes, in terms of quality. So, I saw the tank, and I saw television screen, a very big television screen, and some poor people, some beggars, mendicants, taxi cab drivers, policemen and soldiers were enchanted by what was going on that television screen. And almost immediately I was accosted by a very tall man in a turban, in a leather jacket, who said, "Where are you from, sir?" And with, you know, I like very much to answer such questions literally. I said, "I'm from Ladakh," because I came there from Ladakh. Yes. And he looked at me and said, "Are you in need of the knowledge of Brahman?" Mind it, it was 1987, yes. And I was deadly tired. It was very cold on the platform. And he said, "You know, everybody is in need of the knowledge of Brahman." I said, "Well, you are absolutely right, and I am badly in need of the knowledge of Brahman." Of course, at that time I was badly in need of a cup of hot tea, even with milk. You know, you can't get it without milk in India, yes. And, of course, no reasonable man would ever drink that idiotic potation, that combination of milk with tea. Tea must be drunk as anything else in its purity. Yes, you know that, yes. So I said, "Okay, okay." And he took me by hand and he led me to a kind of very, very old and dilapidated building. And there were at least 400 people. Can you imagine? It was a sort of half house, half tent, absolutely shabby, dilapidated, dirty. And it was a Vishnu Puja. And I spent 2 hours. By the way, I was given a couple of capsules. Very hot, unfortunately, milk tea, as everybody else in the crowd. But, you know, it was a real puja, where the term Brahman was uttered at least, I don't know, several hundred times. It was a real puja. It was as real as it must have been 2,000 years ago. And so we may say that Brahman survived. as an element of cultural India, in spite of idiotic tanks, idiotic television screens, idiotic soldiers, idiotic policemen, and even idiotic tourists like me. It survived. But it survived only due to the fact all other considerations apart. It survived only due to the fact of its proper crystallization for a very long use thereafter. Later on, I discussed that matter with one French Indologist, a good Indologist, I was very interested in the problem why such notions as Atman survived in India. And now we see that the era of enlightenment in Europe, which started in the 17th century, it would hardly survive another 10, 20 years with the reason at its center. And you know, he's very interesting, he's a very good Indologist, well, 150 times better than I. But there is no reason to talk about that with a person who is like you, or even worse, which is almost impossible. Anyway, you know, and we came to one very interesting conclusion, or rather he heard of mine, to wit, that central notions of our culture, as they are inherently, innerly in their nature, very temporary. Let us take such a notion as justice, yes? God Almighty, justice in my mouth is totally different from justice in yours. Justice as conceived of, used and understood in terms of English utilitarian school, Stuart Mill and Bentham, and Bad Bunch, yes, is totally different from justice as used by somebody like Roosevelt or Churchill or even contemporary English or American ministers. When I'm speaking about ministers as a sort of lowest possible denominator for cultural knowledge and use, usually they are at the bottom, yes, because they are too busy. You know, it varies from time to time. It varies from person to person, from nation to nation, you know. Just recently, one very learned gentleman from Damascus, a man of absolutely amazing learning, not only Eastern but Western too, told me quite seriously in this very school that the real idea of justice is that all enemies of Islam must be killed, and the sooner the better. Yes. And you know, try to argue. No, you won't be able to argue really validly, because then you must say, but listen, human body must not be charged, must not be harmed, yes? And then he would answer, no, it is not just, it depends on who you are. And why, after all, it is such a treasure, human body, yes? By the way, if you ask any ancient Indian ascetics, even not to speak of Jainas, is human body a treasure? So, human body is a shit, is a dirt to get rid of, yes? So, the term of justice is very hazy. We take it for granted. Justice is justice. Forgetting all the time that it is, in the best case, It is our justice in the earth. It is my justice imposed on other people. Willingly or unwillingly. Yes. And, but speaking of Atman or of Brahman, they cannot change because they have no positively divine content. It is left to your thinking and to your imagination. It remains, it has remained for millennia and millennia as a kind of, you know, shell for what you or anybody else can think, speak, or do. And that is why all other reasons it survived as one of the axial elements of Indian culture. Now, I would like to give you one other example, simply to make you understand how utterly tangled and intricate our cultural awareness is. Let us take such a simple notion, far more concrete than the notion of Atman Brahman. Temple. Everybody knows what temple is, yes? Mm-hmm. And if somebody doesn't, he must go to the shelves of any library, take any, even the worst possible English dictionary, and he will learn about it. Okay.